Chapter 3. Going Without. For generations, college-going white Americans could count on public money from their governments, whether federal or state, to pay most, if not all, of their costs of higher education. The novel idea of flourishing public colleges, at least one in every state, took shape in the 1860s, when the U.S. government offered the states over 10 million acres of land taken from indigenous people to build on or to sell for institutions of higher education for their citizens. More free federal money for higher education came with the GI Bill, which paid tuition plus living expenses for World War II veterans and swelled college coffers. In 1947, veterans made up 50% of U.S. college admissions. Racist program administration and educational segregation left black veterans in the South largely excluded from these opportunities, however. Public commitment to college for all was a crucial part of the white social contract for much of the 20th century. In 1976, state governments provided $6 out of every $10 of the cost of students attending public colleges. The remainder translated into modest tuition bills. Just $617 at a four-year college in 1976, and a student could receive a federal Pell Grant for as much as $1,400 against that and living expenses. Many of the country's biggest and most respected public colleges were tuition-free, from the City University of New York to the University of California system. This massive public investment wasn't considered charity. An individual state saw a return of $3 to $4 back for every dollar it invested in public colleges. When the public meant white, public colleges thrived. That's no longer the case. Students of color comprised just 1 in 6 public college students in 1980, but now they make up over 4 in 10. Over this period of growth among students of color, ensuring college affordability fell out of favor with lawmakers. State legislatures began to drastically cut what they spent per student on their public colleges, even as the taxable income base in the states grew. More and more Americans enrolled nonetheless, because other policy decisions in the labor market made a college degree necessary to compete for a middle-class job. By 2017, the majority of state colleges were relying on student tuition dollars for the majority of their expenses. The average public college tuition has nearly tripled since 1991, helping bring its counterpart, skyrocketing student debt, to the level of $1.5 trillion in 2020. This represents an alarming stealth privatization of America's public colleges. The rising cost of college feels to most Americans like so many aspects of our economy, unexplained and unavoidable. But at Demos, we researched the causes of rising tuition and linked them squarely to the withering government commitment to public funding. The federal government, for its part, slowly shifted its financial aid from grants that didn't have to be repaid, such as Pell Grants for low-income students, which used to cover 4/5 of college costs and now cover at most 1/3, to federal loans, which I would argue are not financial aid at all. Yes, student loans enable Americans to pay their college bills during enrollment, but the compounding interest means that they must pay at least 33% more on average than the amount borrowed. Millions of students are also paying double-digit interest on private loans. The new debt-for-diploma system, as my former Demos colleague Tamara Drought called it, has impacted black students most acutely, as generations of racist policies have left our families with less wealth to draw on to pay for college. 8 out of 10 black graduates have to borrow, and at higher levels than any other group. In my high school, the seniors had a tradition of posting college admissions letters on the school counselor's wall, right side up for acceptance, sideways for waitlist, and upside down for rejection. So much bravado in that transparency, and yet nobody was putting their financial aid letters on the wall. I borrowed 5 figures for college and nearly 6 for law school, including a high-interest private loan that my grandmother had to co-sign. At 40 years old, I'm still paying it all off, and I don't know a single black peer who's not in the same boat, even those whose parents were doctors and lawyers. Because wealth is largely shaped by how much money your parents and grandparents had, Black young adults' efforts at higher education and higher earnings aren't putting much of a dent in the racial wealth gap. This generation was born too late for the free ride, and student loan repayment is making it even harder for Black graduates' savings and assets to catch up. In fact, white high school dropouts have higher average household wealth than Black people who've graduated from college. As with so many economic ills, student debt is most acute among Black families, but it has now reached 63% of white public college graduates as well, and is having ripple effects across our entire economy. In 2019, the Federal Reserve reported on what most of my generation knows. Student debt payments are stopping us from buying our first home, the irreplaceable wealth-building asset. It's even contributing to delays in marriage and family formation. And by age 30, young adults with debt have half the retirement savings of those who are debt-free. Fundamentally, we have to ask ourselves, how is it fair and how is it smart to price a degree out of reach for the working class just as that degree became the price of entry into the middle class? And how is it fair or smart to create a new source of debt for a generation when that debt makes it harder for us to achieve the hallmarks of middle-class security, a house, marriage, and retirement savings? There is neither fairness nor wisdom in this system, only self-sabotage. Other countries learned from the mid-century American investment in higher education and have now raced ahead. A third of developed countries offer free tuition, and another third keep tuition lower than $2,600. In the United States, recent policy proposals to restore free college are generally popular, though race shapes public opinion. There's a 30 percentage point gap in support for free college between white people on the one hand, 53%, and Black and Latinx Americans on the other, 86 and 82%. The most fiercely opposed? Among the very people who benefited the most from the largely whites-only free college model, and who now want to pull the ladder up behind them, older, college-educated, white Republicans. In the story of how America drained the pool of our public college system, racism is the uncredited actor. The country's first ambitious free college system, in California, was created in 1868 on a guarantee of no tuition and universal access. This public investment helped launch California's rise as an economic giant and global hub of technology and innovation. But the state's politics shifted radically in the 1970s, spurred by a backlash to the civil rights policy gains of the 1960s and, in an important harbinger of national trends, rising resentment of immigration and demographic change. The older, wealthier, and whiter political majority began voting for ballot initiatives opposing civil rights, fair housing, immigration, and taxes. In 1978, a ballot initiative known as Proposition 13 drastically limited property taxes by capping them at 1% of the property's value at purchase, limiting increases in assessments and requiring a supermajority to pass new taxes. Property tax revenue from corporate landowners and homeowners in the state dropped 60% the following year. The impact was felt most acutely in public K-12 schools. California went from a national leader in school funding to 41st in the country. But Prop 13 also swiftly destroyed the local revenue base for California's extensive system of community colleges and put them in direct competition for state funding with the more selective state schools and universities. The resulting squeeze accelerated the end of the free college era in California. Between 1979 and 2019, tuition and fees at the four-year public colleges increased eightfold. Dog whistling was ever present in the campaign to win Proposition 13. From flyers claiming that lower property taxes would put an end to busing for integration purposes, to messaging questioning why homeowners should pay for other people's children. Conservative columnist William Safire put it most directly, however, when he endorsed the proposition in the New York Times. An underlying reason is the surge in the number of ilegales, aliens fleeing poverty in Mexico, who have been crossing the border by the hundreds of thousands. As one might expect, property taxpayers see themselves giving much more than they are getting. They see wage earners, both legal and illegal, getting more in services than they pay for in taxes. A decade later, voters in Colorado, another state with a growing Latinx immigrant population, passed a constitutional amendment severely limiting taxes. TABOR, the Taxpayers' Bill of Rights, has forced Coloradans to go without a long list of public services, including for 2 years children's vaccines when the state couldn't afford to purchase them. And the state has dropped to 47th place in higher education investments. The rise in student diversity shifted the politics of state education spending across the country. As part of the anti-government fervor in the 1980s and 90s, spending on the welfare of youth fell out of favor. But meanwhile, legislatures were tripling their expenditures on incarceration and policing. By 2016, 18 states were spending more on jails and prisons than they were on colleges and universities. The path to this system of mass incarceration is another story of racist policymaking creating unsustainable costs for everyone. The loss of good factory jobs in the mid-1970s hit the cities first, and with cities, their segregated Black residents. Instead of responding to the economic problem with economic development, jobs programs, and stronger safety nets, the federal government cut back massively on urban social spending in the 1980s. In its place, it waged a drug war. Dehumanizing and unpitying stereotypes about the dangers of drug use in the inner cities fueled a new era of harsher sentencing and post-release penalties to create a system of mass incarceration. While the so-called crack epidemic is far behind us, the system rolls on. And today, more than 1.25 million people are arrested each year for drug possession. These are not kingpins or high-level dealers. More than four times as many people are arrested for possessing drugs as for selling drugs, often in amounts so tiny they can only be intended for personal use. In 2016, the number of arrests for marijuana possession exceeded the total number of arrests for all violent crimes put together. The racist nature of our mass incarceration system has been well documented. White and Black people are equally likely to use drugs, but the system is six times as likely to incarcerate Black people for a drug crime. Sentences for possession of crack cocaine, which is more widely used by African Americans than whites, are about 18 times harsher than penalties for the powder version of the drug, which is used more often by whites. For decades before policy changes in 2010, this sentencing disparity was about 100 to 1. Over the last 20 years, however, a striking change has taken place. Getting locked up over drugs and related property crimes has become more and more common among white people, and less so among Black folks. A primary factor in this shift is, as the New York Times wrote, mostly white and politically conservative counties have continued to send more drug offenders to prison, reflecting the changing geography of addiction. While crack cocaine addiction was centered in cities, opioid and meth addiction are ravaging small communities in largely white locales. The pathology, long ascribed to urban communities as integral and immutable characteristics of Black life, drug addiction, property crimes to support a habit, broken families, has now moved with deindustrialization into the suburbs and the countryside. By 2018, an estimated 130 people were dying every day from opioid overdoses, and over 10 million people were abusing prescription opioids. The option to treat poverty and drug addiction as a public health and economic security issue rather than a criminal one has always been present. Will our nation choose that option now that white people, always the majority of drug users, make up a soaring population of people for whom addiction takes over? The woes that devastated communities of color are now visiting white America, and the costs of incarceration are coming due in suburban and rural areas, squeezing state budgets and competing with education. It's not a comeuppance, but but a bitter cost of the white majority's willingness to accept the suffering of others, a cost of racism itself. As racialized as the politics of government spending has become, the victims of this new higher education austerity include the majority of white students. When Demos was working to build the research case for debt-free college, we partnered with a then-small online group organizing students and graduates with debt called the Student Debt Crisis. Now more than 1 million members strong, the Student Debt Crisis, run by Natalia Abrams, a white millennial grad of the University of California, Los Angeles, speaks for an indebted generation, lifting up the stories it collects in an online story bank. We recently polled the activists on our list, and about 70% identify as white, Abrams told me. Josh Frost is 39 and works full-time at a news station and part-time at a gas station. He pays 3/4 of his salary towards his student debt while living with his parents. Though he did everything society told him to do, he's nearing 40 but feels like adulthood is passing him by. I'm watching everyone I know start families and buy homes, he said. Emily Scott from St. Paul, Minnesota, needed to go to college to fulfill her goal of becoming a teacher. She worked 4 jobs while studying to keep her borrowing low, but still graduated with $70,000 in private and public student loans. 4 years after graduation, making payments of $600 a month, she has paid off $28,000, but because of interest rates close to 10%, her remaining balance is $65,000. This is madness, she says. How can I keep up with this? And for how long? Unfortunately for Emily, more than 3 million senior citizens who still owe $86 billion in student loans can attest that the madness doesn't really end. Seniors with student loans are more likely to report rationing medical care, and the government garnishes Social Security payments for seniors in default. Robert Settle Jr. was 60 years old in 2016, and although he is completely disabled and lost all his savings in the financial crisis of 2008, he is still being sued for $60,000 in private student loans he obtained while working for a master's degree to advance his career. Robert points his ire at the government for allowing the system to flourish, and he's eager to tell his story. I want the entire country to see how a disabled, elderly couple is treated by our federal government. The saddest, most common refrain in dozens of interviews and testimonials from borrowers is, "I wish I had never gone to college." If growing cynicism about higher education is the result of this sudden and total shift from public to private, then our entire society will bear the cost. The sudden demise of our public college system and the growing scourge of student debt are recent phenomena, but there may be no question that has vexed Americans for longer than why our healthcare system isn't better, more affordable, less complex, more secure for everyone. We pay more individually and as a nation for healthcare and have worse health outcomes than our industrialized peers, all of whom have some version of publicly financed universal coverage. But the United States doesn't, even though the closest thing we have to European-style single-payer care, Medicare for the elderly, is successful economically and popular with its beneficiaries. Even the theoretical opposition to universal health care is weaker than it seems. At the height of public opposition to the Affordable Care Act, 11 out of 12 of the bill's provisions polled with majority support. In the modern era, more elections have been won, lost, and fought on health care than on any other single issue besides the overall economy. Why can't we fix this? In some ways, the story of America's healthcare dysfunction comes back to the pool. Health insurers use that exact term when they refer to the number of people in the risk pool of a plan. A high number minimizes the risk posed by any individual's health costs. Whether we're talking about insurance, or drug trials, or vaccines, or practice improvements, in health, the key is getting everybody in. Healthcare works best as a collective endeavor, and that's at the heart of why America's system performs so poorly. We've resisted universal solutions because when it comes to healthcare, from President Truman's first national proposal in 1943 to the present-day battles over Medicaid expansion, racism has stopped us from ever filling the pool in the first place. United States Senator Claude Pepper of Florida was a towering figure topped with bright red hair. He gained national prominence when he became President Harry Truman's most reliable Southern Democratic champion for national health insurance. According to Jill Quadagno, who tells the story in her book One Nation, Uninsured, Claude Pepper was a farm boy from the red clay country of eastern Alabama who never saw a paved road until he went to college and entered public life because he believed that government could be a force to enhance the greater good. That farm boy never would have anticipated he'd grow up to be public enemy number one of the American Medical Association. The AMA is a trade group of doctors known to most Americans now for its labeling on consumer products, but in the 1940s it acted as a scorched earth lobbying group whose leadership viewed any kind of insurance that mediated between the patient and the doctor with suspicion. Government insurance, with the potential for cost rationing, portended a threat to the profitability of the entire medical profession. The AMA launched the first modern public relations and lobbying campaign to paint government insurance as a threat not to doctors' finances, however, but to the entire American way of life. They labeled the idea socialist. Racism gave the accusation of socialism added power. Red baiting tapped into many white Americans' fears about what it would mean in the United States to mandate equality, an end to white supremacy. Segregationists regularly tried to marginalize the issue of civil rights by calling groups like the NAACP a front and tool by subversive elements, part and parcel of the communist conspiracy. Claude Pepper's cause of universal health care would ultimately get him lumped in with the communist-inspired doctrine of racial integration and amalgamation. After Pepper came out as a champion of government-funded health care and other liberal programs, he became a prime target in the 1950 election. The effort to unseat him was a coordinated campaign led by a wealthy businessman who opposed Pepper's economic liberalism, including his support for higher wages and taxes. In an early example of plutocratic dog-whistle politics, that is, using racism to further an economic agenda, a group of anti-Pepper businessmen collected every photo of Pepper with African Americans and charged that Northern labor bosses were paying $10 to $20 to blacks to register and vote for him. The physicians' lobby joined in, running newspaper ads with a photo of Senator Pepper with Paul Robeson, the black actor and communist activist. The racist red-baiting campaign worked. Universal Healthcare's biggest Senate champion lost his 1950 race by more than 60,000 votes. The bare-knuckle assault on universal health insurance signaled the beginning of the end of the New Deal Democrats' reign in national politics. Liberal Southern Democrats who saw the transformative potential in government action, like Claude Pepper, were a dying breed. And Harry Truman could not get the segregationist caucus of Southern Dixiecrat Democrats in his party behind his vision of national health care. Truman was the first president to champion civil rights since Reconstruction, desegregating the armed forces and forming a president's committee on civil rights. The Southern Democratic bloc saw the civil rights potential in his health care plan, which was designed to be universal without racial discrimination, as too great a cost to bear for the benefit of bringing healthcare to their region. As Jill Quadagno writes, if national health insurance succeeded, it would be without the support of the South. Needless to say, it would not succeed. Truman declined to run again in 1952, and national health insurance receded from the legislative agenda for the next decade. To be clear, the beneficiaries of Truman's universal coverage would have been overwhelmingly white, as white people at the time made up 90% of the U.S. population. Few Americans, black or white, had private insurance plans, and the recent notion that employers would provide it had yet to solidify into a nationwide expectation. The pool of national health insurance would have been mainly for white Americans. But the threat of sharing it with even a small number of Black and Brown Americans helped to doom the entire plan from the start. After the defeat of Truman's proposal, unions increasingly pressed employers for health care benefits for workers and retirees. By the 1960s, as part of his war on poverty, President Johnson created a generous federal health care program for the elderly, an even whiter population than the overall population, in Medicare, and a less generous patchwork for low-income people and children, Medicaid. Johnson's Congress conceded to leave whether and how to offer Medicaid to the individual states in a compromise with racism that curtailed the program's reach for decades. Medicaid was intended to ensure all Americans living in poverty by 1970, but by 1985, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation estimated that less than half of low-income families were covered. Then corporations began cutting back on offering health benefits to their employees in the 1980s, and the number of uninsured skyrocketed. As of 2020, we still have no universal health insurance. The closest the United States has come to a universal plan is the Affordable Care Act. Created by a Black president, carried into office with record turnout among Black voters, and passed with no congressional votes from the Republican Party. The Affordable Care Act created state-based markets for consumers to comparison shop healthcare plans with federal subsidies for moderate to middle-income purchasers. It also stopped private insurance companies from some of their most unpopular practices, such as denying insurance to people with pre-existing conditions, dropping customers when they were sick, and requiring young adults to leave their parents' insurance before age 26. But Congress rejected the reform ideas that would have relied the most on Americans swimming in one national pool, a federal public option plan, and collective bargaining to lower prescription drug costs. The idea of a Truman-style national health insurer never made it to a vote. As comparatively modest as it was, Obamacare has been deeply unpopular with the majority of white voters. White support remained under 40% until after the law's namesake left office, and as of this writing, it has yet to surpass the 50% mark. Blame President Obama. Not for strategic missteps, blame him for being Black. Numerous social science studies have shown that racial resentment among white people spiked with the election of Barack Obama. When the figurehead of American government became a Black man in 2009, the correlation between views on race and views on government and policy went into overdrive. Professor Michael Tesler, a political scientist at Brown University, conducted research on the way that race and racial attitudes impacted Americans' views of the Affordable Care Act in 2010. He concluded that whites with higher levels of racial resentment and more anti-Black stereotypes grew more opposed to healthcare reform after it became associated with President Obama. Racial attitudes had a considerably larger impact on our panel respondents' healthcare opinions in November 2009 than they did before Barack Obama became the Democratic nominee for president, Tesler explained in a Brown University interview. He also ran an experiment to try to disassociate health reform proposals from Obama. The experiments revealed that healthcare policies were significantly more racialized when they were framed as part of President Obama's plan than they were for respondents told that these exact same proposals were part of President Clinton's 1993 reform efforts. Three researchers out of Stanford looked at anti-Black prejudice and people's willingness to support Barack Obama and his healthcare policies. What Eric Knowles, Brian Lowry, and Rebecca Schomburg found was that respondents who held strong implicit biases were less likely to support Obama and more opposed to his healthcare plan, usually citing policy concerns. Like Tesler, they also tried attributing the same plan details to Bill Clinton and found that the link between healthcare opinion and prejudice dissolved. In sum, they wrote, our data support the notion that racial prejudice is one factor driving opposition to Obama and his policies. Of course, you don't have to look far upstream to find the racialized rhetoric that filled this story in white people's minds. In 2010, Rush Limbaugh's line on the ACA was, "This is a civil rights bill. This is reparations, whatever you want to call it." Representative Joe Wilson was so certain that the ACA would benefit undocumented immigrants that he shouted, "You lie," in the middle of President Obama's State of the Union address. Rural America is experiencing a quiet crisis. Rural hospitals account for 1 in 7 jobs in their areas, but over the past 10 years, 120 rural hospitals have closed, dealing a body blow to the economy and health of the country's mostly white, overwhelmingly conservative rural communities. 1/4 of the remaining rural hospitals are at risk of closing. One thing that all of the states with the highest hospital closures have in common is that their legislatures have all refused to expand Medicaid under Obamacare. Texas leads the country in rural hospital closures, with 26 hospitals permanently closing or whittling down services since 2010. The state has half the hospitals it had in the 1960s. In 2013, an 18-month-old died after choking on a grape because her parents couldn't reach the nearest hospital in time. The outrage from that story swept the state, but it was short-lived. What would reopen the hospitals, according to Don McBeath, an expert in rural medicine who now does government relations for a Texas network of rural hospitals called Torch, is something that the powers that be in the state are dead set against, and that's Medicaid, both fully funding Texas's share and expanding eligibility for it as Congress intended with the Affordable Care Act. I caught up with McBeath by phone at the beginning of the coronavirus outbreak and asked him why Texas's hospital system was in crisis. "There's no question it's the uninsured in Texas," he said, and then let his characteristic sarcasm slip in. "I mean, we're running about 25-26% before the Affordable Care Act, and now, oh gosh, yeah, we're down to a whopping 16%. So that is a huge problem. When you know that 1 out of every 6-7 people walking in your hospital is not going to pay you?" I asked him if, as my research had suggested, Medicaid expansion would help shore up the rural hospital system. "I'm sure you're aware Texas has probably one of the narrowest Medicaid coverage programs in the country," he said. I was aware. I'd had to double-check the figure because I couldn't believe it was so low, but in fact, if you make as little as $4,000 a year, you're considered too rich to qualify for Medicaid in Texas. And even that has exclusions, as McBeath explained. "I hear this all the time. Even some of my friends will go, 'Oh, those lazy bums, they need to get off that Medicaid and go to work.' And I go, 'Excuse me? Who do you think's on Medicaid? First of all, there's no men on Medicaid, period, in Texas. No adult men unless they have a disability and they're poor. And there's no non-pregnant women, I don't care how poor they are.'" Failing to insure so many people leaves a lot of unpaid medical bills in the state, and that drains the Texas hospital system. The conservative majority in the Texas legislature has been so opposed to the idea of Medicaid that they shortchanged the state's hospitals in compensating for the few, mostly pregnant women, Medicaid patients they see. Then, by rejecting Obamacare's Medicaid expansion, they lose out on federal money that would insure about 1.5 million Texas citizens. As a result of this and some federal policies, including budget cuts in the government sequestration that the Tea Party forced during Obama's second term, rural health care is rapidly disappearing. Texas politicians' government bashing is both ideological and strategic. They benefit politically by stopping government from having a beneficial presence in people's lives. As white constituents' needs mount, the claim that government is busy serving some racialized other instead of them becomes more convincing. McBeath sighed. "The thing we've seen in this state is our politicians have so demonized the term Medicaid expansion that they'll never reverse course on that as long as they're in control. And we can prove to them all day long that it may be the way to go, but we quit barking up that tree because we're not going to get anywhere." What the mostly white and male conservatives in the Texas legislature are doing to sabotage the state's healthcare system doesn't hurt them personally. The state provides their health insurance, but it's costing their state millions. Before Medicaid expansion, working class people had basically no option for health insurance. Most low-wage employers don't offer coverage, and buying it on your own cost an average of $4,000 a year for families. If you were under 65, this left only Medicaid, whose rules were mostly set by the states, in another Southern congressional compromise, leading to an average income eligibility cap of just $8,532 for a family of three, well below the minimum wage for one earner. If you lived in a southern state, the likelihood of your being eligible was even lower. Alabama, $3,910. Florida, $6,733. Georgia, $7,602. Mississippi, $5,647. Texas, $3,692. These are the paltry annual amounts that a parent in a southern state must earn less than in order to qualify for Medicaid in 2020. Adults without children are usually ineligible. When the Affordable Care Act passed in 2010, it expanded qualification for Medicaid to 138% of the poverty level for all adults, about $30,000 for a family of three in 2020, and equalized eligibility rules across all states. But in 2012, a Supreme Court majority invoked states' rights to strike down the Medicaid expansion and make it optional. Within the year, the lines were drawn in an all-too-familiar way. Almost all the states of the former Confederacy refused to expand Medicaid, while most other states did. Without Medicaid expansion, people of color in those states struggle more. They are the ones most likely to be denied health benefits on the job. But white people are still the largest share of the 4.4 million working Americans who would have Medicaid if the law had been left intact. So, a states' rights legal theory, most often touted to defend segregation, struck at the heart of the first black president's health care protections for working class people of all races. Expanding Medicaid should be a no-brainer for states cost-wise. The federal government paid 100% of the cost for the first few years and 90% into the future. The states that expanded saw hundreds of thousands of their working-class citizens go from being uninsured, where an accident can cause bankruptcy and preventable illnesses can become fatal, to being able to afford to see a doctor. The benefits don't stop with individual people, though. Stable Medicaid funding has allowed rural medical clinics and expansion states to thrive financially. In Arkansas, the first southern state to accept expanded Medicaid, a health clinic in one of the poorest towns in the country has constructed a new building, created jobs, and served more patients, creating measurable improvements in the community's health. Terrence Akins, an outreach employee at the clinic, told a reporter in 2020, "What we've experienced in the last few years has been nothing short of amazing." Why wouldn't a state's politicians take free money to have such amazing health and economic outcomes in their communities, including rural ones with disproportionate conservative representation and fewer options for economic activity? It's not that it's unpopular. Expanding Medicaid has polled higher than Obamacare since the bill passed. The answer is all too familiar: racism. Colleen M. Grogan and Sungun Ethan Park of the University of Chicago found that racialization affects state Medicaid decision-making. First, they found that just after the Supreme Court decision that made it optional, Medicaid expansion had robust support among Black and Latino Americans at 82 and 65%, respectively, but slightly below majority support among white Americans at 46%. Across the country, state-level support for Medicaid expansion ranged between about 45 and 55%. And interestingly, some of the highest support was found in the South, where the larger Black populations drove up the average. But that larger Black population also prompted a sense of group threat and backlash from the white power structure. Grogan and Park found, as the percent of the Black population increases, the likelihood of adoption decreases. The zero-sum story again. As with the public swimming pools, Public health care is often a benefit that white people have little interest in sharing with their black neighbors. Grogan and Park's model found that it didn't matter whether a state's communities of color supported the expansion if the white community, with its greater political power and representation, did not. State adoption decisions are positively related to white opinion and do not respond to non-white support levels, they concluded. When I pointed out this study to Ginny Goldman, veteran community organizer in Texas, she threw her hands up. For 10 years, Ginny built a nonprofit called the Texas Organizing Project, or TOP, which aimed to improve Texas's democracy by engaging residents of color in issue activism and elections. Ginny gives one the impression of being battery-powered. She's a fast talker with eyes that size you up quickly. But she's just as quick to reveal her deep compassion for people who struggle. The idea that it wouldn't matter how much black and brown Texas supported better health care if white Texas did not, it just flies in the face of everything that we spend our time doing, she told me. Ginny tells her members, there's power in numbers. You're the majority. You have to organize. You've got to get out. You've got to vote. You've got to be loud. But then, as the study I showed her suggested, there's actually this tiny sliver of a minority of people who will outdo you. The thing is, that tiny sliver is overrepresented in Texas government. Texas is considered a majority people of color state. 41% non-Hispanic white, 40% Latinx, 13% black, and 5% Asian in 2018. But the legislature is 2/3 white and 3/4 male. After the Supreme Court Obamacare decision, TOP joined a coalition advocating for Texas to expand Medicaid above its abysmally low income cap of $3,692 so that more working and middle-class Texans could be insured. The upside for Texas was clear. One out of every 5 non-elderly Texans lacks health insurance, the highest percentage in the country. The problem is not just about poverty, either. The state has the highest uninsured rate for families earning less than $50,000 a year, who would be eligible for expanded Medicaid, but also the highest uninsured rate for those making over $100,000, who may qualify for middle-income subsidies under Obamacare. The uninsured are disproportionately Latino, but there are over 1 million white non-Hispanic Texans without any health care coverage. The benefits of Medicaid expansion would be widespread, the cost minimal. But as soon as the Supreme Court made it optional for states, the state's governor, Rick Perry, did his announcement, which was like, hell no, I'm not taking the money, Ginny recalled. I asked her what arguments Texas's leaders made for turning away free money to help solve the state's worst-in-the-nation health coverage crisis. She recalled accompanying TOP members to state legislative hearings. And Republican legislators would say, you know, these folks are going to come out of the woodwork like bugs. These freeloaders who are just going to come out from everywhere, and comparing them to insects and bugs, rodents, asking for stuff. This particular racist trope, the language of infestation, is usually deployed against immigrants and, in the current immigration debates, those from Latin America. In Texas, Latinx people are the largest group of uninsured. But Ginny saw how some in the very community that would be most helped by Medicaid expansion were inclined to oppose it because of anti-black stereotypes about Medicaid. When we first started to collect postcards and signatures and support around this, I remember Latino organizers coming back to the office and saying, we're not doing very well. Because a lot of the folks in Latino communities were like, we don't want a handout. We work for what we earn. We're not asking for anything for free. That's a late-stage benefit of a 40-year campaign to defund and degrade public benefits. In the end, they're so stigmatized that people whose lives would be transformed by them don't even want them for fear of sharing the stigma. I think Republicans were pretty good at what they're always good at, right? Pitting communities against each other and using a lot of dog-whistle politics around, like, Medicaid equates to black freeloading people, Ginny said with a sigh. And unfortunately, that's resonating, or hitting some of the underlying tension that already exists between African Americans and Latino communities. So we had to fight a lot against that. The Texas Organizing Project campaigned within the deserving versus undeserving narrative it was dealt. Our talking points were overwhelmingly like, we work, why can't we have healthcare? So we always had to go out of our way to kind of counter this sense of, you know, just this idea that people are wanting free stuff and not carrying their part. If you're trying to understand Texas's healthcare crisis, Jenny believes you can't ignore conservative white Texans' resistance to the first Black president. Abbott, who's the governor now, was the attorney general then. And he would just say, I get up in the morning, I go to the office, I sue President Obama, and I come home. It was just so apparent that it was like, we can't have Obama having any success, even if it makes perfect sense, economic sense and healthcare sense, for the state. There's just no way it's happening. Interestingly, the strategy to deny President Obama victories did make some inroads even with the president's base. Jenny recalls that when people still weren't getting healthcare, especially first-time voters and communities of color that we were organizing, they blamed it on Obama at first, because the Republicans' megaphone's just always bigger than ours. The struggle for affordable healthcare for the working class continues in Texas and, as of summer 2020, 12 other states. Meanwhile, conservatives threaten Obamacare with court challenges, legislative repeals, and regulatory rollbacks. The healthcare advocates I spoke with could still remember people they knew who died because without insurance they couldn't afford to see a doctor. Toward the end of our conversation, Jenny began to cry while recalling a funeral of a woman who was the daughter of one of the first people I ever organized with, this African-American man whose daughter died because she had lupus, a highly treatable disease. She had to wait and wait and wait until it got really, really bad. Then she could go to the emergency room. Then they would give her something. Then they would turn her out. And she can never get ongoing care. She can never get medication or any treatment. She worked all sorts of low-wage jobs from one to another. She has kids, and she's dead at my age, in her late 40s. Jenny's voice shook with both grief and rage. People are dying because they would choose a political victory over an actual victory that serves millions of people. For Ron Pollock, a 50-year leader in the fight for health care, housing, and other anti-poverty measures, the person he won't forget is John, a Texan he met over 20 years ago during the Clinton administration's lost battle for universal health care. John told us the story about his wife, Ron told me. He worked for a radio station, wasn't making a lot of money. He talked about his wife being a very strong person, and she started getting stomach pains, and John would say to his wife, you know, we've got to see a doctor. And she said, well, we don't have the money to see a doctor. I'm going to be okay. And this persisted for months until one day she collapsed in excruciating pain, and she was taken by ambulance to a hospital, and they found this huge tumor in her stomach. And it was a very advanced tumor, and it was clear that she was going to pass away from this. And while she was at her deathbed, we were going to start the bus trip across Texas to advocate for universal health care. And John was encouraged by his wife to get on the bus for 3 weeks to join us. And John said, well, I don't feel comfortable leaving you like this. She said, the last favor I have of you is that you join the bus trip and tell my story, so that nobody experiences what we have experienced. We were about halfway in the trip, and his wife died. And he flew back to bury her. And then he flew back to rejoin the bus. And he told his story at the White House. And of course, there wasn't a dry eye in the place, Ron said, his voice getting weak with the weight of the memory. He cleared his throat. So, yes, there have been quite a few people I have met, too numerous to count, who paid the ultimate price for their inability to get health coverage. After a moment, I asked him about John's racial background. He was white. Ron Pollock was born in 1944, during the golden era when the government erected the structures that created a white middle class, comprised of the sons and daughters of millions of European immigrants, like his own parents. He became a young man during the brief part of that century, when all three branches of the U.S. government took major leaps towards realizing the American dream for all her children, regardless of race or status, and it forever shaped him. I grew up in the period when, in the 1960s, there was this tiny glimmer of hope that we were going to do something serious about poverty in America. Ron was the student body president at the then tuition-free City University of New York when his classmate, Andrew Goodman, was murdered on a trip to Mississippi during Freedom Summer. And from then on, he threw himself into what would become a lifelong fight to extend America's promise to all. He founded the country's premier anti-hunger organization, the Food Research and Action Center, whose litigation and advocacy helped create the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program for women, infants, and children, including the food stamp program that feeds nearly 40 million Americans. His organization, Families USA, was at the forefront of both the Clinton and Obama healthcare reform battles that eventually won healthcare for 25 million people. And at 76 years old, he has lately turned his passions to preventing evictions and ensuring affordable housing. Ron Pollock is not a household name by any means, but he has dedicated his life to extending the public web of protection around more Americans. And tens of millions of Americans are better off because he has. When I got the chance to talk with him, I wasn't so sure that he'd be willing to speak about the often invisible headwinds of racism in his anti-poverty efforts. I've known many a white liberal who was uncomfortable talking about racism's impact on politics. But he never shied away from naming racism. And when I asked him my final question, he shared with me the vision for America that has guided him through 5 decades of advocacy. Ron said that, in his vision, nobody in this country is deprived of the necessities of life, whether it's food, whether it's healthcare, whether it's housing, in a country that's as wealthy as ours. To realize this vision, he said, I wish there was a greater consciousness about how we're all in this together. For those people who are opposed to government aid out of an animus to people who look different than they are, that lack of social solidarity causes harm to their own communities. If we didn't have these sharp divisions based on race, we could make enormous progress in terms of making sure that people are not hurting as badly as they are, or deprived of what clearly are the necessities of life. And I would like to think it was possible if we had a sense of social solidarity. Ron Pollock's diagnosis of the United States, that we suffer because our society was raised deficient in social solidarity, struck me as profoundly true. And true to my optimistic nature, I suppose, I found the insight galvanizing. I began to think of all that a newfound solidarity could yield for our country, so young, so full of promise and power. Starting with healthcare and public college, I began to see the solidarity dividends waiting to be unlocked if more people would stop buying the old zero-sum story that elites use to keep us from investing in one another. The stories of the declining public university and the shuttered public pools have parallels across the country, from the infrastructure we have, collapsing bridges and poisoned pipes, to the public goods we are desperately missing, universal childcare and healthcare. There's a way to tell these stories without race, as my early colleagues at Demos attempted to do. That story makes sense. Up to a point. But when I became the organization's president and had the chance to lead a new research project over a decade later, the Race Class Narrative Project, I made sure to add race to the investigation. Working with my old law professor, Ian Haney Lopez, and the linguistics expert, Anant Shankar Osorio, I discovered that if you try to convince anyone but the most committed progressives, disproportionately people of color, about big public solutions without addressing race, most will agree, right up until they hear the counter message that does talk even implicitly about race. Racial scapegoating about illegals, drugs, gangs, and riots undermines public support for working together. Our research showed that colorblind approaches that ignored racism didn't beat the scapegoating zero-sum story. We had to be honest about racism's role in dividing us in order to call people to their higher ideals. A coalition of grassroots organizations in Minnesota decided to use our research to develop messages during the 2018 election, an election they knew would be a referendum on demographic change in their historically white state. Once a Northern Tea Party hotbed, Minnesota had more than its share of right-wing politicians who campaigned on fear about the state's growing Latinx and African Muslim population of refugees and immigrants. The coalition's organizers used insights from our race-class narrative project to develop a campaign they called Greater Than Fear. Minnesota organizer Doran Schrantz recalled, "We decided to emphasize the joy and benefit of things we do together, like sharing meals at a potluck and the feeling of shared accomplishment that every Minnesotan knows, digging each other out of the snow." But instead of an all-white cast for these campaign videos and posters, the Greater Than Fear storytelling included faces of all shades pushing a minivan out of the snow, and Muslim women in hijab sharing dishes of homemade food with white women at a potluck. The narratives weren't communicating simply feel-good diversity. It was a familiar and values-based way for door-knocking canvassers and volunteers at phone banks to open up conversations about what all Minnesotans needed: healthcare, better infrastructure, more funding for education. And the campaign specifically called out the opposition strategy of dog whistling by using humor, asking voters to send in pictures of their dogs to show real dogs standing up to racist dog whistling. The gubernatorial ticket of the Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party, the state Democratic Party, adopted the Greater Than Fear messaging for its campaign in its final weeks and won. The Farmer Labor Party also took control of the statehouse, allowing the advocates in the Greater Than Fear coalition to have a bigger say in shaping the state's budget. The budget that emerged was a repudiation of the conservative policy of prioritizing corporations, the wealthy, and insurance companies while underfunding our schools, transportation, and healthcare, according to a statement by the majority leader when the budget was introduced. The House Speaker boasted that the budget would freeze college tuition and take steps towards enacting a public health care option. Honest investments for families, no matter where in the state you live or what you look like. This kind of cross-racial public investment could be a new governing ethos for America, a country that has always linked what we give to who you are. As we become a nation with no racial majority, we will need more of this spirit to create a new basis for investing in ourselves, broadly and without prejudice.